listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we dig into the 75-year history of women in the Air Force. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a nonprofit that helps families in the Madison area.
For many survivors of domestic abuse, finding affordable housing can be a challenge. And then finding furniture to fill that new space, that can be less of a priority. But as WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, one nonprofit is providing families in Dane County with sofas, beds, and decor to turn their apartments into homes. Jaisha?
Yeah.
Okay, she likes blue.
How about these?
Oh, give them those. Okay.
All right.
Oh, what about those pink light lamps?
Yeah.
It's a Saturday morning, and Felicia Denny is on a mission. She needs to find furniture for a family of two sisters. They need items like a couch, a bookshelf, and an end table. We're on the second floor of Denny's house. She and her mom are choosing furniture for a family she's never met. Their work is part of an organization she founded during the pandemic called Felicia's Donation Closet.
What we do is we fully furnish abused women and children's apartments when they move out of homelessness.
Denny and her crew of volunteers help make a family or individual's house or apartment feel like home. To date, they've furnished more than 50 apartments. What started with a potential couch for sale turned into a full-scale operation. She donated her furniture to a mother through a community shelter. And from there, the idea to create a nonprofit took off. Donations rolled in, demand soared. Denny has a full-time job, but she would spend hours driving and delivering furniture to families on weekends. And for Denny, the mission is personal.
I'm a survivor myself. And I just felt that I needed to do something back, give back to the community. Just from the experiences I went through, had I known that there were so many other resources out there, I probably wouldn't have stayed so long in some of these really horrible relationships.
At a storage unit in Wanakee, Denny is moving furniture and directing volunteers.
Okay, you guys want to grab this dresser?
I got it.
Go ask the older.
Careful. Hey, you're going to break that.
It's a canvas. Come this way.
Denny says many of the women she works with have gone through hardships. Some are homeless. Others have been raped. And she says when people finally get a job or their own apartment and come back to an empty home, it only makes it that much harder to leave the abusive situation.
That's when you always start questioning, did I make the right decision? Should I go back? Because usually the abusers would keep finances for them, and that's how they trap them.
Denise says that's why helping people during what is sometimes their most vulnerable moment is so important.
So we are that missing aspect to make that home a sanctuary for them. That way they know that they are making the right decisions, they are in the right steps, they are heading the right direction, they can just move forward and become, you know, the beautiful women that they are, that they deserve to be.
You guys might want to go the other way so you can turn it, like come out.
Denny and her team eventually arrive at a Sun Prairie apartment and begin to unload furniture for sisters Jaisha and Jessica Edwards.
All right, it's kind of a tight squeeze.
After their mom died in 2015, the Edwards family bounced around from Chicago to Sun Prairie. Jessica says her family had been on the waiting list for a new apartment for over a year.
There are so many emotions going on right now inside of me. Like, I don't know whether to cry, smile, you know. I'm just blessed because a few years ago today, I would have never thought we would have been here.
And to top it off, their home comes fully furnished. As she looks to the future, Denny says the bigger the donation closet gets, the more families they can help.
I think when it really hits me is when we're there and then we walk in, we're done with everything, and then like their whole house is filled of everything, that the moms get emotional, and that's like usually when it gets me, because then I'm like, oh my God, don't cry, it's gonna be good now.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Felicia's Donation Closet in Dane County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, it's a big event in the skies over Wisconsin this week. The Experimental Aircraft Association holds its annual Air Venture in Oshkosh with lots of planes and even more people. One focus this year, women in aviation. Our next two guests are speaking at the event today. First, Michelle Curran, call sign Mace, was a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force for 13 years, completing missions across Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. From 2019 to 21, she was the only female pilot of the Air Force's Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron. After leaving the military, she founded the company Upside Down Dreams and wrote a children's book with the same name. She gave a keynote speech earlier today at the EAA event and appears this evening on the Women Venture panel. And she was born in Medford, Wisconsin. I talked to her yesterday after she'd arrived at Oshkosh. When did you first get the notion that, hey, I want to fly a plane?
A lot later than I think a lot of people expected. While I was flying for the Thunderbirds, I had a lot of interactions with kids. And so a lot of people would ask me if I was, you know, 20 years ago, if I was one of those kids. And actually, I grew up in northern Wisconsin. I don't know if you knew that or not, but I'm a Wisconsin native. And I just did not have exposure to really aviation or the military. I was only a couple hours from EAA Air Venture, and I didn't even know what was going on. But it was about halfway through college that I went and visited a military base, and I got to see a couple of fighter aircraft taking off in full afterburner. And that was kind of the first time I had exposure to that. And it was just a pivotal moment for me. I got goosebumps. It was kind of one of those jaw-dropping experiences. And from that day, I was like, okay, how do I figure out how to go do that?
Now, fast forward, you were the second ever female lead solo pilot of the Thunderbirds. Can you, first of all, tell us what that means and what it meant to you to take that place in the group's history?
Yeah, so I flew for the Thunderbirds from 2019 through the 2021 season, so 3 years. And the team has been around since 1953, so this year is the big anniversary for them. And it was really an honor to be part of that legacy. And you know, it was a lot of responsibility, I think, to be in such a public-facing position as one of only a few women, because the Thunderbirds' mission is really to inspire the American public and to, you know, recruit the next generation of military aviators. But for the little girls that were watching the air shows, for them to see someone that they could relate to and someone that looked like them was pretty powerful. And so it was really an honor to be able to fulfill that role. And as the lead solo, there's six jets that you'd see in the air show if you've ever seen the Thunderbirds fly. Mm-hmm. The one out front is Thunderbird 1. He leads the entire demonstration as well as the whole squadron of 130 people. But there's the two solo pilots that do kind of the maneuvers that make a lot of people gasp, like the head-on passes where it almost looks like a high-speed game of chicken, all the flying upside down, the high-G maneuvers, the really fast climb rates. That's all the solo pilots. And so the lead solo is the more experienced of the two. And I was responsible for kind of all of the timing and communication and just coordination for our element of two aircraft.
Now, at any point in that stretch from your first idea that, yeah, you wanted to fly a plane to hitting this pinnacle for pilots, for fighter pilots here, were there obstacles based on being a woman where people thought, what's she doing here?
Definitely at different points throughout my career. When I first decided I wanted to do that, you know, gender didn't really come into the equation of, you know, me making that decision. It was just something I wanted to do. I didn't really think that much about it. As I got into more of the competitive kind of training pipelines for the Air Force, it started to get highlighted to me quite a bit. And then as we got into these, you know, very competitive spots where we have a class of 25 people and only one or two fighter aircraft are going to be available for that entire class, it can get, these people are your friends, but it can also get kind of cutthroat. And that's when it really started to get highlighted to me by a few people in the class that there was some notion that I was going to get that spot because the Air Force was checking a diversity box, which is not something that they do. Like, the standards are pretty dang high and you have to meet them. And so I ended up doing well enough to get, you know, one of those two fighter aircraft. And then there was just kind of this feeling of responsibility where I had to set the reputation for any women that would follow in my footsteps once I was actually in the, you know, a fighter cockpit and I was in one of the squadrons. And I also felt like I was under a microscope, right? Like, I wouldn't say people are waiting for you to fail, but people definitely are paying attention to what you're doing. And so that can be a little bit, you know, extra stress on top of the already stressful career. But by the time I got to the Thunderbirds, I definitely saw it as an asset because of what I mentioned. I could relate to, you know, all the women and girls in the audience in a different way than my male peers could.
Talking to Michelle Curran, call sign Mace, longtime fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. Five female pilot, a solo pilot with the Air Force Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron in Wisconsin for the EAA Air Show. Now, Mace, you've taken up another step in your career now. Children's book author. Can you tell us about Upside Down Dreams?
Yeah, so my first kids book, Upside Down Dreams, just came out in July, so very recently. And it really has great reception. It's been a bestseller on Amazon, and it's just been really cool to see all the photos and the reviews, you know, roll in of all these kids reading it. And it was a long process. The idea for the book came to me in 2019 when I was visiting the Smithsonian Museum in D.C., and then I didn't have time to actually start working on it until the pandemic when a lot of our air shows were canceled. And then it took me another 2 years to, you know, find a publisher, actually get it out in print. So kind of a four-year journey. It's a passion project because I just got to have so many cool and inspirational connections with kids in person where I could see kind of that light bulb moment happen for them when they saw, you know, a woman doing what I was doing. And so I wanted to be able to continue to reach and inspire kids in that way once I was no longer flying for the Thunderbirds. And that's where the book kind of came into play.
You were able to fly with the Thunderbirds in your home state of Wisconsin. Now you're at EAA in Wisconsin. What does it mean to you to take your career, to take your love of flying, your message for the next generation back to your home state?
It was just really special every time I get to come home. And, you know, I did the Milwaukee show. It was just really cool. I got to have a lot of my friends and family there, which is just such a neat opportunity to be able to show them, you know, what I was doing at that point in my career. And then to come back to Oshkosh, I was here last year for the first time ever, which was surprising to a lot of people because, you know, I grew up just a couple hours from here. So having never been to Oshkosh until after leaving the Thunderbirds was a little bit of a shocker to the aviation community here. But once I came here, I was like, I have been missing out and I need to come back. And so I'm keynoting this year, doing book signings, part of a forum, and it's just really cool because I know a lot of people watching are kids from small towns in Wisconsin, and I think they can see themselves in me, and that can be really impactful for them to chase down whatever their own goals are.
Well, Mace, have a great time back in Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michelle Curran, call sign Mace. I talked to her yesterday from 2019 to 21. She was the only female pilot on the Air Force Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron. She's speaking today at the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. Coming up, we'll hear from another pilot and speaker at that event who wrote a book about the history of women in military aviation. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about women in flight as the EAA Air Venture continues in Oshkosh. Now we're taking a look at the history of women in combat flight. Starting 75 years ago with the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, which allowed women to join the military. Other big anniversaries this year, too. 30 years ago, women started to fly combat aircraft. 50 years ago, women started to be trained as military pilots. Eileen Bjorkman is a retired Air Force colonel and author of the new book, Fly Girls Revolt, the story of the women who kicked open the door to fly in combat. Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You share this big history. You are part of this history. A lot changed from when you first joined the Air Force in 1980. Can you talk about your personal story, first of all?
Yes, so I came in the Air Force in 1980, and women were just starting to, you know, come in larger numbers. They'd started training as military pilots in 1973. The Air Force started training women as military pilots in 1976, and so there was still a fairly small number of women that were flying at the time. I couldn't go to pilot training because my eyes weren't good enough, and I actually found a loophole in the combat laws where I could fly as a flight test engineer, and I could fly in the back seat of fighter aircraft because they weren't considered combat planes; they were considered test airplanes in the test business. So I was actually able to fly in some of those aircraft in the mid 80s, and then had a front row seat to watching all of the laws change and the policies change in the 80s and the 90s.
What was at the center of that change? Who took the lead in making the case that women can fly, including flying combat missions?
I think what's really interesting about that is it wasn't a single individual. There were lots of different women who were involved in that fight from starting actually back in the 1960s. There was a woman, Jean Holm, who was very instrumental. She was a two-star general in the Air Force eventually. She was very instrumental in opening additional roles for women. She knew combat was a bridge too far in the 60s and 70s, but she continued to advocate for women even after she retired. There was a group called the Women Military Aviators, that was, the small numbers of women military aviators that did exist. They came together, they started writing to their, congressmen and their leaders and explaining why the laws really needed to change. And then there were several congresswomen that were very supportive as well. Patricia Schroeder, in particular, comes to mind. So.
Now, you are speaking at Air Venture. You're sharing your book. You're on a panel, I think, later this afternoon with a group of women, including Mace Curran, who we just heard from. What kind of things are you hoping gets out there to this this big audience at Air Venture?
So they're going to hear a little bit about the history, not too much, because the focus is on the women who've actually been able to fly in combat. But yes, we're going to hear from one woman who was in the Air Force in the mid-80s when women were not allowed to fly in combat. She's going to talk a little bit about her experiences, and that's General Jackie Van Ovost. And then we're going to have the first three women fighter pilots in the Air Force are going to come on and talk about their experiences as the first women and what it was like for them. And then, a little bit about their first experiences in combat. And then we're gonna bring in the younger women like Michelle Curran, Mace Curran, and they're gonna talk about how things are today and some of their more recent experiences. So it's gonna be a little bit of a history lesson and a little bit of, where are we today? And just emphasizing to everybody that, women can do anything in the military now. There really are no limits.
And Eileen, you're making the case for more women in aviation. And included in that, we think aviation, we think you're flying the plane. Hang on, you wrote a piece that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about the need for more mechanics in aviation. And one of the things you say is, hey, we've got this untapped potential of women getting into aviation mechanics. Can you talk about that side of the industry, military and civilian?
Yes. So women are very small numbers, even in the civilian side of things. As I mentioned in that article, women are only about 3% of mechanics. And so there's, like I said, there's a huge untapped resource there. And for airline pilots, only about 5% of women are airline pilots. And so, again, there's a huge untapped resource in this country that we need to use if we're going to have a very strong, be a strong leader in aviation, which we are.
How important is it for you to have role models front and center? I mean, your book traces this chain of, people who inspired the next generation to advance a little further. How important is just like seeing someone, maybe for that young girl in a small town like Mace was talking about, seeing someone in aviation potentially being that inspiration?
I think it's important. I didn't have a lot of role models when I was in, obviously, but there were women that I knew about, like Jean Holm, that I think, oh, she could do it. I can do it too. And I have heard lots of stories of people telling me about their experience of seeing a woman and then all of a sudden realizing that, oh, I can do that too. I heard one story about a little girl that I think it was here at Oshkosh. She came to Oshkosh with her family, and there was a woman with her T-38, woman pilot with her T-38 here, her training airplane, standing by the airplane, and she saw her and realized that I could be a pilot too. So I think a lot of it is, there's that saying, you can't be what you can't see. And so I think having representation is very important.
Now, you served in the Air Force. I hope you don't mind if I bring up another branch of the service. We have a joint chief's nominee to head the Navy would be the first woman to head one of the branches of the military. How important is it for you to see that glass ceiling get broken?
Well, again, I think it's very important. I think the main consideration is that she was the best person for the job. She obviously has a background that makes her very qualified. But I think being able to, put her up into that position definitely sends the right message to, the American people and to the world, is that, everybody in the United States has opportunities to go as far as they can and as far as they want to.
Now, in Fly Girls Revolt, you tell the story of women being able to take on more and more roles in military aviation. Are we at the point you want to be at right now, or are there still barriers to be broken, or at least numbers to be brought up?
So I would like to see more women in aviation in the military. About 20% of the Air Force is military. About 20% of the Air Force is women. You'd expect that about 20% of our pilots would be women, and we're nowhere near that. We're about like the airlines, we're around 5%, and it's even smaller numbers with fighter pilots. So again, I don't believe in quotas, but there are definitely barriers. There are things that are keeping women from either becoming interested in aviation in the first place, or they're leaving aviation because of family issues and things really that we can help deal with in the Department of Defense.
You're at Air Venture now. Are you seeing a pretty solid gender mix as far as the crowds turning out for the big event?
I am. I'm very thrilled with the number of women that I see here. We just had our picture taken today out on the flight line, and it was a huge crowd. And everybody's wearing their blue T-shirts today, and it's just like a sea of blue here. So I'm very pleased with the crowd.
Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us. Enjoy your time here in Wisconsin.
Thank you. I always do.
That's Eileen Bjorkman, a retired Air Force colonel, author of the new book, Fly Girls Revolt, the story of the women who kicked open the door to fly in combat. She talks about the history of women in the Air Force. She's speaking today at the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. Also tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a lot of content for kids on YouTube, often unregulated and uncurated content. So parents don't know what they're getting and what their kids might get into. Find out what's out there, get some advice for parents, and some good alternatives for kids to watch that you can kind of trust and count on. And the Barbie movie is a big hit, and its main character has a pretty big history in American culture. We'll look at the impact of Barbie dolls from the early days to the big screen. Are you now, or have you ever been a Barbie fan? Have you seen the movie? Love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, restaurants are bouncing back from COVID. According to recent national numbers, people are going out to eat, but restaurants still face some high costs. We'll check in on the state of the restaurant business here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, two workers' rights advocates talk about the state of child labor laws in the U.S. after the deaths of two 16-year-olds in factories, one here in Wisconsin. First, new data from Yelp, OpenTable, and the U.S. Department of Commerce show that Americans are dining out more now than in previous years, to the point that they're spending more at restaurants than at grocery stores. But even though restaurants have been experiencing more traffic, there are concerns in the industry over costs of food, labor, and credit card payments. We're checking out the state of the restaurant business here in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How often do you go out to eat? Have your habits changed over the last few years? What kind of dining do you enjoy? Fast food, fine dining, something in between? How about takeout? Where does that fit into your meal decisions? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you work in restaurants or own a restaurant, love to hear your perspective on changes you've seen in recent years. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan Quam is the Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, these national reports I'm looking at, Susan, suggest that, yeah, people have gone back to restaurants since the low point of COVID. Numbers of at least customers looking pretty good to compared to pre-COVID times. What are you hearing from restaurants here in Wisconsin?
Well, we're definitely hearing that the demand is there. We know that people are willing to travel again and get out, and our tourism industry is definitely on the mend from, you know, pandemic related issues. And restaurants play a huge, you know, role in tourism here in the state. And even folks are saying their local traffic is up and is doing well. It looks like in our world, you know, consumer spending is up about 8% in the last 12 months in restaurants, where, you know, non-restaurant type of spending is just up less than a percent. So we know people want to go out, and we know people are out there, but part of the concern is whether or not they can, you know, that our operators can meet that demand.
I'll say personally, I definitely got more in the habit of doing things like delivery or takeout during COVID. Am I normal? Is that something that a lot of restaurants are seeing more continued demand for the takeout services than, say, pre-2020?
They definitely are. You know, utilizing carryout or doing even having delivery either by a third party company or by the restaurant employees themselves was definitely on the rise pre-COVID. And then we saw, obviously, that was some of the lifeline that a lot of restaurants had to keep themselves open. That while it has gone down compared to COVID times, we definitely are still seeing a much higher use of delivery and carryout than what we were seeing in 2019.
Now, more customers sounds like pretty good news. There are some other factors out there. We've seen concerns over the last few years about labor, the costs of labor. Can restaurants find enough people to keep up with that demand? What are you seeing out there?
Well, we're seeing that, you know, in the last 18 months, average restaurant has increased their wages to their employees by over 25%. That's pretty significant compared to the national average of wage increases that you've seen around the country. And even with the increase in wages and additional and the great flexibility and part-time opportunities that the restaurants have and offer many of their employees, especially those who are, as we call them, front of the house, you know, the folks that you see that are serving customers, we're still over 12,000 employees behind what we were in prior to the pandemic. You know, so we're down 6%. The restaurant industry in Wisconsin prior to the pandemic employed 9% of the working population. We now employ 8%. That 12,000 people is a pretty significant number of openings that we have.
And so we all may have noticed the price of food, especially in the midst of higher inflation, going up. I'm guessing restaurants aren't exempt from those forces.
They are not. In fact, they're hit even harder than the general consumer is seeing in the grocery store. You know, we have some products that are running like at 100% or even higher than what they were just 18 months ago, especially things like deep fry oil and other fats and greases that are used in the industry. And in a state that depends on things like the Friday night fish fry, that's a pretty hefty expense in increase on a large volume product. And there's quite a few other commodity products that are, you know, involved in bakery goods, a lot of our center of the plate items like beef and other items, you know, they've definitely seen, especially in the restaurant side of it, a much higher increase inflationary than you see in the grocery store.
Talking to Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, talking about the latest news from the restaurant business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you dine out more than you used to once upon a time, say 3 years ago? Do you get carryout more often? Do you work in restaurants or run a restaurant yourself? What are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, with these costs, both of labor and lack of labor in some cases, and those higher food costs, what kind of changes have you seen restaurant owners make to adapt?
On the food side of things, what we're seeing is a lot of operators are just streamlining their menus, or they may be trading out certain things in their menus for other things as substitutions, both in order to get the products that might be available or to, you know, take advantage of something that might be have a little bit lower price point that they can incorporate, which in turn also helps them not have to raise their menu prices as high as they should be doing in order to make up those costs. So that's definitely something that we are seeing out in the operations. And you might see even at your favorite supper club, the menu is going to change, or the types of entrees that they're offering might change in order to meet the demands of that particular customer base. On the labor side of things, you know, I mentioned before our, you know, the wages are increased on an average of about 25% just in the last 18 months. But there's a lot of things that like we're doing with our members and the folks that we touch up here at the Restaurant Association is helping operators also understand the other types of things they need to be the employer of choice. So they do a great job of retention of the employees that they have. So that's definitely something that we're seeing. But in as well as that, we're also seeing restaurants aren't going to be open as many hours as they used to be, or in many cases, as many days as they used to be, because they want to make sure that they give the employees that are there for them time off so that they can have days to do their errands and get some days of rest and have some time off, just like every other person in the marketplace. So a lot of restaurants that used to be open 7 days a week, they're now open 5 days a week or even less than that. And then it's not just Mondays and Tuesdays they take off. Sometimes we're seeing restaurants are taking off, you know, are closing on a Sunday or a Thursday, which are normally higher traffic days, but they want to make sure that they have a rested staff for the other busy times that they have during the week.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gabriel is with us in Platteville. Gabriel, hi.
Hi, Gabe. I'm you and I, Gabriel. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know, I'm first time caller, first time listener. I live in Texas. I'm just happen to be driving through Wisconsin and happy to be here. So I was just wanting to make a comment that unfortunately for the last 2 to 3 years, my family is not as financially stable as we once were. And we're still working on it, and we're working on, you know, making progress. However, I have found it a trend for me over the past 2 or 3 years to download apps for fast food restaurants. And it's something that I've been doing that in search of a way to save money. And, of course, there's always the convenience factor. However, it is unfortunate because I find that the more that I use that stuff, the more I rely on it. And obviously it's not the healthiest of options. And it's not very encouraging. But that is the comment that I wanted to make. And thanks for taking my call.
Gabriel, thanks for the call and welcome. Enjoy your time here in Wisconsin. Susan, Gabriel grappling with, you know, he finds himself eating fast food more often, he says, not sure about the health side of things. I don't know, what an insight into one consumer's thinking on restaurants there.
Well, I can definitely empathize with Gabriel's, what he's looking for is every consumer out there is concerned about the prices that they're seeing. And definitely our restaurant operators are hearing that too, about menu price increases. One thing that a lot of operators are doing, especially in the quick service or fast casual marketplace, is they are instituting loyalty programs. And a lot of the apps that Gabriel was referring to, definitely have opportunities for the app users to get earn free items, maybe get a free, something free for that day, or they earn money off, and they encourage repeat usage of that. And what those folks are doing is trying to drive repeat business, which, helps increase the volume that they're doing. And with the average restaurant making only 3 to 5% profit margin pre-tax, driving, while they may be lowering their profit margin by doing what they're doing, they're driving up the volume of business and making up for it. So that's definitely an area. But I know that a lot of other restaurant operators that aren't in that space are definitely looking at other types of loyalty programs or ways to reward customers that are repeat users at their restaurant, and allows in doing so also, keeps their base business going. As far as the nutrition side, I would have to say, there are some great choices at all of our restaurants out there for those folks who are looking for specific nutritional types of food or certain things that they're looking for. So those options are there, Gabriel. Just hopefully you can take advantage of them maybe the next time you're using your app.
Thanks for the call, Gabriel. We're talking to Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, looking at recent consumer trends in dining and how Wisconsin restaurants are doing in the current economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go out to eat a lot, or do you get takeout from restaurants a lot? How has it changed for you over the last few years? What are you seeing? Are you seeing differences when you go to your favorite restaurant? Different hours, a different staff all the time, the menu changed? If you work in the restaurant business, love to hear about your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Susan Quam, Executive Vice President of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. We're talking about trends in dining, the latest on the restaurant business, and how they've recovered from the early days of the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. If you own a restaurant, how has inflation, especially with food costs, maybe labor costs, affected your business? What are you doing to keep up with what your customers want? If you go to restaurants, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Southern Wisconsin. Rick, hi.
Hi. I got a question for you. How are the restaurants in the area supposed to keep up with the food trailer business during the pandemic? A lot of the quality employees went out and did their own thing, and now we're forced to try to do things with the younger generation without training, and you end up going to product instead of Housemates products because they don't have...
Rick, I think we lost our connection there, but Susan, Rick seeing... problems, competition from food trucks, losing that experienced labor in some cases, and the difficulty of training new people.
Well, he's definitely experiencing a lot of some of the issues that restaurant operators around the state are looking at. And I think one of the biggest issues we're seeing, and this happened during the pandemic, is that a lot of folks who had part-time jobs or maybe a full-time job in the restaurant and hospitality industry when the pandemic hit and the prolonged shutdown in certain areas, a lot of those folks went and found jobs somewhere else in totally different industries, and they have not come back to the restaurant and hospitality side. So that is a definite reason why we're short on those 12,000 employees that I mentioned earlier. The thing that we're encouraging operators to do, especially when it comes to recruiting and keeping your employees, and especially working with the younger generation, say the Gen Z, is really starting to learn what is most important to those employees and why and what they are looking for as they are becoming employed and learning, you know, to work with the different generations. Because what we have been finding and learning is that, you know, each generation learns differently. Each generation has different reasons for why they work and what they're looking for in their employment. And so we want to encourage our operators to be that employer of choice and definitely tailor their training and what they do to help engage their employees in that respect. As far as food truck goes, you know, the food truck industry is booming. We see it as definitely part of the restaurant industry. Many, many times individuals who get into the food truck biz go on to open brick and mortar restaurants. It's an entrepreneurial way for people to get into our business. And so as long as there are fair rules in place for where food trucks go and how they operate compared to the brick and mortar restaurants that they're competing with. We look at it as, you know, as a great way for people to get into the industry. And as I said, to build up their brand and become a brick and mortar restaurant in the future, contributing to the tax base of their communities and everything that, you know, restaurants bring to the table as far as community support.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Sammy is with us now in Green Bay. Sammy, hello.
Hi. So my thoughts on this is even before the pandemic, I was noticing it where just, you know, you pay $50 for a meal at a restaurant and it's really not that good. Like, you could make that better yourself if you made it at home and for a lot less money. And now that same $50 meal for two people is closer to $80 before you even have to pay for the tip. And it's not any better. It's usually a little bit worse than it was before. So it's hard for me to justify now going to a restaurant unless I know that the quality is there.
Sammy, thanks for the call. Sammy worried about prices going up. And she says, Susan, not seeing the quality there.
Well, it's unfortunate that she's had those experiences. And I know that there's plenty of restaurant operators out there who would love to have the opportunity to showcase their hospitality and their team's cooking talents for you. So I encourage you to continue to try looking for other places. But as far as understanding the economics of a restaurant industry, you know, you're right. You can prepare that food at home because you're purchasing in the grocery store. But, you know, food costs, you know, traditionally are only about 1/3 of all of the costs within a restaurant. You also have your labor costs. You have the cost of gas and electricity and all of the fixtures and equipment and pieces of You know, whether it's to-go containers or, you know, flatware or anything else that's in a restaurant. And in and on top of that, you have the credit card processing fees that go with that, that, you know, all of those factor into the fact into what that menu price is. And in the end, if you're paying $10 for something, you know, that you have purchased at a restaurant, only 30 to 50 cents of that is going to contribute to any form of bottom line profit for that operation. Everything else is spoken for in all of the other costs. And that is the struggle that restaurant operators have, trying to meet that value proposition that their consumer and their customers are looking for, but also provide all of the other services that it takes to prepare that meal away from home.
Thanks for that call, Sammy. You mentioned those credit card fees, Susan, and I know that's a legislative priority for a lot of the restaurant business groups out there. What's going on? What are you hoping to see change?
Well, you know, credit card processing fees are have become the third largest expense for restaurants and many retailers that are out there. But for the fact that it's the third largest expense behind labor and food costs is pretty significant in our industry. And because there's a lack of competition, especially when you dive into all of the intricacies of how those fees are determined, who actually is doing all the routing of the processing and everything else, you know, there's just not a lot of competition there. And what we're doing on a federal level is working real hard to get something called the Credit Card Competition Act passed in at the federal level that would allow restaurant operators and all other merchants out there to be able to have the choice of a couple different options for the back routes and operate that their credit cards are routed through, so that there is some competition, therefore driving down prices and helping bring that relief not only to the merchants that are out there, but to all of the folks that are paying with their credit cards. So we're definitely working on that at the federal level, and here at the state level in the recent budget, we were also able to secure some help for restaurant operators that, you know, have to collect all of the state and local taxes on behalf of government, and increasing the reimbursement that the state gives back for collecting those taxes, since the majority of those taxes are also collected by credit card.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mike is with us in Eau Claire. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've worked in restaurants for most of my life. The last place I worked at, I was there for a good 4-5 years. I gave them everything. And I mean, that owner, you know, I'd be lucky to get a smile and a hello out of them in the morning. You know, if the, you know, those local restaurant owners, if they could learn how to treat their employees with a little respect, they might not have them, you know, throw their apron on the floor and walk out of there on a Friday night rush like I did. So.
Mike, sorry, it was a rough job. And Susan, you've mentioned you work with restaurant owners to try to help keep people like Mike on the job. What kind of things do you offer restaurant owners when it comes to employee relations?
Well, sure. You know, and I'm sorry that he had that kind of experience. And you know, every industry and every business has, you know, their operators that are people and those who are not. And again, what we're also always encouraging restaurant operators is that they need to be the employer of choice. They need to work with their employees and develop the right culture within their operations so that everybody you know, is a valued part of the team. And there's a lot of successful restaurant operations from independent operators up to, you know, some multi-unit franchisees and everyone in between that we know can do a great job of valuing their employees and putting, you know, the best foot forward as far as working with their employees. And we try to help give those solutions on staffing and all those different types of ideas that employees are looking for. And especially as we look and are starting working with the youngest generations of our workforce right now, you know, it's not necessarily pay or the rate of pay that someone's getting that is what they're looking for in their employment. And, you know, they're looking for something else relating to how they interact with their job and with their team members. And we're helping operators understand that and implement that in their operations.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. It was my pleasure.
That's Susan Quam with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. She joined us for a look at recent trends in the restaurant industry. Coming up after the news, we'll look at child labor laws in Wisconsin and around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.